This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think the Keystone Pipeline is kind of maybe the perfect example here. The Keystone Pipeline now isn't even economical because of how expensive tar sands are and where oil prices are. That wasn't the fight that we were having 8 years ago. So we're in a very different place.
The New York Times recently compiled a list of 104 environmental protections that the Trump administration has rolled back in 4 short years. They include major climate policies as well as rules that ensured clean air and water, preserved wildlife, and regulated toxic chemicals. With the election of Joe Biden, however, many are hoping for a dramatic and immediate reversal. This week on Sea Change Radio, we unpack some of the key items on our environmental wish list for the incoming Biden administration with Mother Jones reporter Rebecca Lieber. We talk about restoring our standing in the world by re-entering the Paris Climate Agreement, look at possible variations of a Green New Deal, and ponder what can be done with or without Democratic control of the Senate. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rebecca Lieber. She's an environmental reporter for Mother Jones. Rebecca, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be on.
So we are talking in the aftermath of Joe Biden's victory to become the 46th president of the United States. And you have written a lot in the past, 18 to 24 months, about what Democrats, whoever the nominee may be, what they should do in terms of the environment, if they were to take charge. So here we are now, and you're crafting a new piece, which will be coming out shortly. So why don't we start with the Paris Climate Agreement? Because that's one thing that I think we've covered a lot on the show, and it seems like a no-brainer, but what's the timeline for that? And how much does the Senate, if at all, come into play with the administration's efforts to rejoin this agreement?
Right. Not sure if your listeners are already aware, but last week we had a few historic dates collide, and one of those was the U.S.'s official exit from the Paris Climate Accord. That came on Wednesday. Now, since Trump kicked things off a few years ago of pulling the U.S. out of the agreement, that date came around and the U.S. was automatically pulled out of it. Now, of course, with Biden coming in, things change really drastically because he has said day one he will re-enter the U.S. in the agreement. Now, luckily, this does not require Senate. He can just sign the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement, which will take 30 days to kick in. So by February, the United States will be back in. Now, on the policy front, there's a lot he has to do, though. This isn't as simple as signing a piece of paper, because the U.S. is behind on where the Obama administration promised the world it would be at in reducing its climate emissions.
So when you say policy, you mean in terms of complying with the Paris Climate Agreement? We'll have some work to do to fulfill our end of the bargain. Is that correct?
Right. And the Paris Agreement is this non-binding accord where you have countries volunteering domestic targets for how much they cut their pollution by. So while this isn't binding, the U.S. has a lot of work to do to convince the world that we are a reliable partner in fighting climate change. Trump has done everything in his power to convince the world that the U.S. cannot be relied upon. And even if we do elect a president who cares about climate, that we could have a change of administration and then another Republican president withdraws us. So Biden's task here is one, to establish trust again and relationships with countries that are fighting climate change. So European countries and even China and India are taking big steps. So he's going to have a lot of work to do to build those alliances again. And the other thing he'll have to do is resubmit a target. So he is going to say how much he expects the U.S. can reduce its pollution by 2030. Now, we don't have a precise target yet from him. There are some numbers that I've heard thrown around. And the one that would be in line with what activists and science says is necessary would be a cut of about 40%. That's far more ambitious than what Obama set out for 2025. And of course, miles more ambitious than where Trump had us.
So in May of 2019, you wrote a piece for Mother Jones, Rebecca, entitled, "If 2020 Democrats are going to be serious about climate, they need to cut out Congress." So here we are in a situation where there's the possibility that the president does not have both houses of Congress on his side. He's facing one of the clearest conservative Supreme Courts of the last generation or two. And if anybody was following some of these debates, not just national races, but a lot of statewide races, the Green New Deal has become a conservative talking point. The conservatives have decided that the Green New Deal is a great wedge issue for them. Will they be labeling this the Green New Deal or shying away from that, in your opinion? And maybe kind of give us an idea of what an overarching climate plan, whatever it's called, will look like.
I think the hopes of environmental activists to see really ambitious, grand legislation that finally updates the government's response to climate action, something labeled under a Green New Deal, I think those expectations have to be checked a bit given what results we have from the election. Even with the question of Senate control still up in the air, it's a really big uphill climb to get to that that big picture legislation similar to the 2009 Waxman-Markey fight. We remember how that went with failed climate legislation. However, there is a lot of good news here. You can have a Green New Deal or get close to it with pieces of legislation, and there are chances for compromise and for bipartisan compromise. One of those areas is highly dependent on how an economic stimulus shapes up. That is something that the Biden team has hinted or has said will be a big priority when they come in. Finally, bringing Congress behind some kind of package that invests in people and businesses suffering from the COVID pandemic. And after that, thinking about actual stimulus funding, really on the level of 2009 stimulus package, where we saw huge investments in clean energy and infrastructure. And the other thing to remember, and I think the story I reported on years ago and looking at again now on executive action, is the president has a lot of powers here, especially under the Clean Air Act, to tackle climate change. So that's important to remember, that not all of this is entirely in the hands of Congress, that a Biden administration can seriously raise the expectations for the power sector and for the transit sector. And in other areas like energy efficiency and buildings and financial markets, that the president has a lot of powers, and we've just seen 4 years of languishing authority on this because of Trump. But it's important not to forget that. So I think what we're going to see from the Biden administration and from Democrats is this kind of piecemeal approach that adds up to hopefully looking like ambitious climate action. I think the idea that one day we get the Green New Deal introduced and passed through Congress, it might not look exactly like that, but we could get some part of the way there. And I want to just measure how optimistic that sounds, because Congress is very important for getting us to reduce emissions in some sectors of the economy where it's much more difficult for the EPA to weigh in here. And finally, the other thing you mentioned here is the kind of obscure state and local races that are really important for climate action. And I think that's the other piece of this for people to remember, is states and local action on climate is hugely important for how fast we bring down our emissions.
Yes, I mean, when you look at California, it's the fifth largest economy in the world. Do you think that might be a template for the Biden administration to kind of have something in place fairly quickly, especially when you consider that Joe Biden's running mate is a senator from California?
Yeah, I think California, the last 4 years especially, has been really interesting that how the state's leadership really sets the tone for the country. And I think a good example of this are clean car standards, where Trump came into office, very quickly decided to roll back these rules that were very popular for having more fuel efficient vehicles. Now, California for decades has set more ambitious standards than the federal government for cars. And there has been a fight with the Trump administration over who would win out in this battle. But California has continued that leadership. And I think that's one reason why we didn't see something like the car sector and climate completely fall apart, because California has still been setting that higher bar. And because it's such a big economy, it basically, when California passes tougher standards for climate, it is setting a tone for the nation. So that has applied for cars, that's applied to buildings and electrification, and also this major environmental justice law that California has passed in the past few years. I think you see the state really setting that tone. And as far as Harris's commitment to climate, it will be really interesting to see how big of a voice she takes on in the administration, because as a candidate for president, she was very vocal about climate. She was often out first embracing a Green New Deal, embracing actually a ban on fracking, which goes further than where President-elect Biden has the position he's taken on the issue. So it will be really interesting to see if she takes a really proactive role on climate.
I see my freedom from across the way, and it comes right in one time, when it shines so bright, and it gives so much light. Yet it comes from the sky above, make me feel so free, make me feel like me. Yet it lights my life with love, yet it seems like, yet it feels like, yet it seems.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Mother Jones environmental reporter Rebecca Lieber. So, Rebecca, we were talking about the Biden-Harris administration and their view on the climate and energy issues. Anybody who was watching the race evolve over the last year and a half through the primary and these last debates with Joe Biden and Donald Trump, was, it seemed like the light had gone off for a candidate like Joe Biden, who had not been a huge climate hawk in the past. But I think it resonated with him at some point during his candidacy. This is a terrific, not just talking point, but it makes a lot of sense on so many levels. We both work in the environmental journalism area, and it's a very large palette. Did you see some kind of the winds of change shift in candidate Biden at some point? And what does it mean that we have this candidate who's run for the first time on explicitly on climate change?
Yeah, I think you're picking up on something that's really important about the campaign. If you asked me at the outset of this campaign if climate would really rise as a not just an electoral priority, but like in terms of rhetoric from Biden of being really out front on this, I probably would have been skeptical because of many election cycles where candidates have kind of tried to hide or run away from this issue as a liability, you really saw Biden embracing this as a strength. And I think this actually goes to, I think, something that's not unique to Trump. It's unique to the Republican Party in that they have become the party of science denial. And I think especially when COVID broke out, there was some worry that from activists that climate would really take a back seat in the campaign. And that didn't happen. And I think a reason why is because the climate denial fits in so well with the rest of the narrative about the Trump administration, that he doesn't listen to scientists, that he is endangering people by not listening to the science. And what better example than that of that than on climate change, when we have wildfires and hurricanes threatening Americans? So I think that's one reason, especially the last year, climate has continued to really dominate the election, even when there have been crises left and right. And as far as when Biden maybe took this kind of shift on climate, I think this really happened in the primary. And I think the credit goes to a very competitive field of candidates that were prioritizing climate. You had way back when you had Governor Jay Inslee running as the climate candidate, Senator Bernie Sanders prioritizing climate, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Harris, they all made climate a really top priority, releasing plans that forced Biden into a bit of a corner that he had to get more specific. And of course, I think I've profiled activists like the Sunrise Movement in the past of how their strategy of pushing Democrats in a more aggressive direction on climate, how that really paid off. Because I think activists, there's often this choice to make. Do you go after Republicans? Do you try to do you point out their science denial, or do you really hold your own party accountable? So I think Sunrise Movement, environmental justice advocates, there are a lot of people who really pressured Biden in this more aggressive direction. And the final piece here that I think we saw Biden evolve on is how much he's embraced environmental justice as a platform point. And I think that was a huge shift, especially the last few months with the rise of Black Lives Matter protests, that Biden had released another plan directly talking about how he will prioritize racial justice from an environmental angle in his administration. Environmental justice advocates for decades have wanted to see this issue rise to the top of people's radars. And I think we've really seen that happen or start to happen the last few months. And Biden has now said he will really prioritize us when he comes in. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, but I think it's really held the Democratic Party accountable to the people of the party.
Hearing you say this, Rebecca, makes me feel a little more optimistic about the future of what we're going to see in the next few months, which inevitably are going to be some selections in terms of Biden's cabinet that are going to displease a lot of people we respect and environmentalists on Twitter, et cetera. And the reason I'm a little more optimistic than I may have been before our conversation is like when you hear about like Ernest Moniz being the potential Secretary of Energy or Eric Garcetti being the Transportation Secretary, you hear a lot of middle of the road names being thrown out there. But hearing what you're saying about Joe Biden and his evolution, and I think a lot of cabinet members will be a lot more amenable to listening to Green New Deal advocates moving forward than they would big oil, because I think even big oil realizes in general that there's a financial incentive for them to transform their business on the fly.
Yeah, I think the question of how much Biden pulls from characters we saw in the Obama administration versus also bringing kind of newer on the scene climate activists into the fold, That'll be really interesting to watch that. But we're also not at the same point we were during the Obama administration, when Democrats, including the president, would regularly argue that fracking is a bridge fuel, that gas is a bridge fuel to cleaner energy, or as you were talking about, nuclear as the only solution for climate change. And I think the debate's gone much more nuanced since, and honestly much more aligned with the science, especially on natural gas for Democrats. So I think one thing is we're just past that point in some cases, but the appointments will certainly matter a lot.
And the financials have changed quite a bit since the Obama administration, because we've seen such a dip in the cost of renewables.
Yeah, clean energy costs have come down a lot, and also advancements in the technology for battery storage. And we're seeing where renewables are just completely leaving coal and sometimes even leaving gas in the dust on being a more reliable investment. So just, I think the Keystone Pipeline is kind of maybe the perfect example here. The Keystone Pipeline now isn't even economical because of how expensive tar sands are and where oil prices are. That wasn't the fight that we were having 8 years ago. So we're in a very different place.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental reporter Rebecca Lieber. So, Rebecca, you mentioned that we should just do a whole episode on the future of nuclear power, and we definitely will. We could also do an episode or two on cap and trade and carbon tax plans. What are the status of those two proposals? And maybe you can kind of fit that under the umbrella of the Clean Air Act and what power the EPA will have to unleash these plans now that it's going to have its handcuffs removed, so to speak.
Yeah. So we were talking before about what Congress will be needed for and versus the executive branch, and carbon taxes and cap and trade, basically economic wide changes. Those certainly, Congress needs to come along on this. Congress needs to pass legislation, and carbon taxes are a major example of that, where you do need new laws. That said, there are things that the executive branch can do, though they are risky. We are talking about how striking a balance, the White House will have to strike a balance between what really pushes the envelope on climate action and what will survive courts. And of course, no one can forget that we have a very deeply conservative Supreme Court now, and that does possibly change the calculus on how far Biden might push that envelope.
Maybe you could give a quick outline of what the differences are between cap and trade and carbon tax, and how they may or may not work within the Clean Air Act.
Right. So both of these ideas, a carbon tax and cap and trade, have been discussed not just by Democrats, but Republicans, economists for years and years. Now, these are they have a lot of similarities. Cap and trade, as the name suggests, there's a cap on absolute emissions from industries, and then you have credits that you can trade or buy to basically as you reduce that cap and eventually bring down those emissions. A carbon tax is effectively similar, but you say we will tax the carbon emissions, carbon pollution from industries, and often it's combined. The idea, there's a fight between having it revenue neutral, where you return it in tax breaks, or you use that money to invest in communities and invest in clean energy programs. So these are both ideas that are, it's really important to have Congress pass laws to make this legally possible. Though there's one idea that has come up when I've asked lawyers, just like dream big, what could possibly happen on climate change if a Democratic president was just wanted to throw everything at it. And one of those ideas is using the Clean Air Act in a really creative way of interpreting a portion of the Clean Air Act to say that the EPA actually has a power to set cap and trade policy. This is a bit controversial because it's a whole new area of law that hasn't survived a bunch of court challenges. So it's kind of untested in courts, which makes it more risky. But that's an idea that let's say we have an administration that's just run out of its options on climate and wants to invoke a broader policy that affects bigger parts of the economy. That's an idea that I've heard lawyers express some skepticism, former EPA lawyers and experts kind of express some concern about even using this tool, but it is out there. It's a possibility. We'll have to see how Biden interprets this mandate that environmentalist says he has to act on climate, and how, I guess, how broadly he thinks the executive branch should be used to take action.
Well, thank you for giving us that overview of what to expect, and people should read your piece as it comes out this week in Mother Jones. Rebecca Lieber, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's so great to be on. Thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, Van Morrison, and Shonen Knife.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.